Looking back to Project Mercury, a 6-year anniversary for men in space.
I left Hangar S in a mobile van that we affectionately called the cattle car and went down to Launch Complex 5 at Cape Canaveral, as it was in those days. When the mobile van arrived at the launching pad, it was still dark, since it was about 5 o'clock in the morning and the launch was scheduled for 7 o'clock. We spent a few moments at the...
You're listening to astronaut Alan Shepard, America's first man into space, recounting the historic sequence of events of 6 years ago and his flight aboard Freedom 7.
Looked right. I left the trailer, and I remember looking at the launching vehicle, the Redstone, as I walked toward it and saying to myself, you'd better take a good look at it because this is the last time you're going to see it.
NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, presents a special report, Freedom 7 Revisited. Where were you that day, May 5th, 1961? It was an important day for this country's manned spaceflight program. The day that astronaut Alan B. Shepard, inside his Mercury capsule named Freedom 7, blazed the trail for succeeding manned missions. By today's standards, the flight plan was a simple one, a 15-minute suborbital mission designed to carry the pilot on an arching trajectory into space and right back down again. But that quarter of an hour represented a culmination of 3 years' intense preparations by the Mercury team. And today, 6 years later, no one remembers that moment more vividly than the man who experienced it, Alan Shepard.
I remember feeling, at the time the hatch was closed, that this, in fact, would be the day of the flight. Everything had been proceeding very normally, very satisfactorily up until that point, and I just felt that we had gone through such a rigorous system of tests and spent so many days in readying the spacecraft and the Redstone for the flight that this certainly had to be the day.
Lift off and the clock has started. Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go, 1.2 G, cabin at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go.
The liftoff actually occurred at 9:34 Eastern Standard Time. And I remember feeling a moment of exhilaration at this particular time. Exhilaration because, of course, I had been training for 2 years for this moment. The training days had been long and hard. Some of the decisions had been hard to make. A lot of stop and go had occurred in the program. And in fact, I was more than ready for the liftoff to occur and was quite delighted that, in fact, it did occur and occurred so smoothly.
And the isolated battery is 29.
I recall feeling some slight vibrations during the maximum dynamic pressure phase of the liftoff, some which we had not expected, others we had. I made mention of this actually during the powered phase of flight, noting only that it was something we had not expected, but that it wasn't really disturbing. The spacecraft which I flew did not have a large window, a large picture window, as we called it in those days, in front of the pilot. Therefore, my view of the Earth was through portholes on the side or through a periscope which was projected in front of me. I remember feeling after a few moments of looking at the spacecraft instruments, working the controls, that I should look down at the Earth to really see what it looked like. And I must admit, the view was extremely arresting.
On the periscope, what a beautiful view. Cloud cover over Florida, 3 to 4 tenths near the eastern coast.
It was just so magnificent, something which I had not been prepared for, and something which none of the subsequent pilots have really been able to prepare for. The flight plan which I went through was very short. very uncomplicated by today's standards, but nonetheless one which did exercise all of the systems of the spacecraft completely. By that I mean we used the manual control systems and the automatic control systems, completely exercised both of these systems during the flight. One of the problems that had been of greatest concern during the time period prior to my flight was the reaction of man under weightless condition. Now, of course, we had practiced in airplanes before the flight, but only for short periods of time, maybe as long as 20 or 30 seconds at the most. And there was a great deal of discussion, differences of opinion, really, as to how a man would react for the long period of 5.5 minutes under weightless conditions. It was, in fact, for that period of time, and as we have proven since, quite a pleasant sensation. The sensation of floating, particularly when one is strapped to a couch or a seat, or when one is restrained in some way, is not unnerving at all, and certainly does not interfere with man's capability to read his instruments, to accurately describe their condition, to move the hand controllers, to work any of the gadgets, knobs, levers that he has in the spacecraft. This was pleasantly surprising to me, and certainly to those on the ground, I'm sure, when I reported to them that everything was proceeding satisfactorily. I must admit that the flight seemed all too short, and I soon realized that I had to prepare myself for the re-entry. This meant, of course, positioning the spacecraft so that it was headed in the proper direction, with the large or blunt end facing into the atmosphere at an angle slightly below the horizontal. This was done easily, and was done using the manual control system on the spacecraft.
Start retro sequence in retro attitude, arc green. Retro one, very smooth. Retro two. Retro three. All three retros are fired. Okay, this is Phantom 7. G build up. 3, 6, 9. Okay. Okay.
Coming through loud and clear.
Okay. Okay. This is 7, okay. 45,000 feet now. 40,000 feet.
The re-entry itself proceeded quite as we had expected. We had, in fact, spent a lot of time on a centrifuge, familiarizing ourselves, simulating the actual acceleration load which we would encounter during the re-entry. The accelerations built up smoothly and very much as we had expected. I was again pleasantly surprised to find that I could react and move essentially up to the same G levels as we had experienced in the centrifuge, that is 6 or 7 Gs, that I could in fact breathe normally beyond that and could in fact talk intelligently up to the peak level of 11 Gs which I sustained during my re-entry.
The drogue is green at 21. The periscope is out. The drogue is out. Standing by for main. Main on green. Main chute is raised. Main chute is green. Main chute is coming unraised and it looks good. The main chute is good. Rate of descent is reading about 35.
The drogue came out as planned. The main parachute came out as planned. And in those days, again, I had to use the periscope to see the main parachute. but I could in fact see it, and I must admit, as others who followed me have admitted, that it was a very welcome sight.
Affirmative, Indian Capcom. Let me give you a report. I'm at 7,000 feet. The main chute is good. The landing bag is on green. My peroxide has dumped. My condition is good.
I landed very close to the recovery forces, and I was able to start communicating with them as soon as the main chute had opened and I was drifting down toward the water.
15 minutes and 22 seconds after liftoff, at 9:49 a.m., Freedom 7 splashed down in the Atlantic, with astronaut Shepard in good condition. The mission, a success. What did this success mean for man in space?
Well, that's very difficult to answer. The single most important contribution is very difficult to pick out. However, I do feel that the evidence presented from my flight that a man could, in fact, operate in a vacuum environment, in a spacecraft with a reaction control system, under weightless conditions, even for short periods of time, and do the job which had been planned for him to do, to come back in, make the recovery and reentry as was planned. I think this really is the point, the facet of the flight that gave us the confidence to go on to bigger and better things later on.
Did astronaut Shepard anticipate that in the 6 short years following his flight, man would so rapidly expand his capabilities in space?
Yes, I think so. You must recall that in 1961, when I made my flight, we were already well into the planning stages for the Gemini program and involved in the preliminary planning stages for the Apollo program. So those of us that were, in fact, involved in those programs were pretty much aware of what we felt we could do. I feel that we're probably more fortunate in this respect, since in addition to actually training for flights, we have the opportunity to find out about future plans. So it's not as much of a surprise to us as it is to some of the other people who are not in the same position.
Since the end of Project Mercury, astronaut Alan Shepard has been chief of the astronaut office at NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas.
I'm responsible for 46 astronauts now in my office. Of course, it's primarily an administrative setup here in Houston, and I am, in fact, responsible in this area for care and feeding, so to speak. But really, the most important thing that I do is to coordinate the engineering inputs which the office has made and still makes to the space program itself, to the design of the spacecraft, to the operational procedures which must be followed in flights. It always has been a fine situation where the engineers with whom we work consider our opinions during the course of the design and the planning for the flights. Of course, they don't always agree with us, but at least they listen to us. And it is a very important thing to do, and that's my biggest responsibility, is coordinating these efforts during the training phase. One of my other responsibilities, which actually occurs during the final 2 months prior to the flight, is that of directing the activities of the crew and their supporting people in place at Cape Kennedy. Actually, Deke Slayton and I alternate on these missions, and together, successively I should say, we are in place down there at the Cape, coordinating all of the efforts, schedules and plans the crews must fulfill during their last few days, primarily in order to relieve the crew commander of that responsibility.
Alan B. Shepard, America's first man in space, now in charge of preparing other astronauts for their increasingly complex array of missions. Missions which 6 years ago he himself helped bring about with his pioneering flight aboard Freedom 7. NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has presented a special report, Freedom 7 Revisited. This is Willard Scott speaking. Thank you.